is the Annex, a sociology podcast. I'm Joseph Cohen.
I'm Leslie Hinkson.
And I'm Gabriel Rossman.
Today, our guest is Eric Schwartz, editorial director at Columbia University Press. Eric has been at Springer, Princeton, Cambridge, and Oxford. He's a poli-sci PhD from the New School, but a longtime fixture in the world of sociology publishing. Today, reactions to perceived shortages of marriageable men. Our discussion was recorded on October 7th, 2019.
Okay, so on October 4th, the Wall Street Journal touched on an issue that we discussed recently and, you know, will have aired by the time you guys hear this, which is the marriageable men shortage. And, you know, this is a longstanding issue in family demography, closely tied to the closing and now lapping of the education gap by gender, where I forget when it was, but, you know, 20 years ago or so, there were more women attaining bachelor's degrees than there were men. And to the extent that women tend to practice hypergamy, this implies a shortage of marriageable men. Anyway, so the substance of it, we already discussed last week. So just back up last episode and you'll hear our discussions of the merits. But today I pitch that we discuss how people react to this, because what we didn't mention as much is that people tend to get really mad when you're told this and tend to have more moralistic than, you know, analytical perspectives on it. And so when the Wall Street Journal had an op-ed on this, and I read the op-ed and it basically reflected the social science. I mean, you know, like any good sociologist, I could have said you forgot to cite this or that, but it basically, you know, reflected the social science. And they announced it with a tweet that said, "Women with college degrees outnumber men by a significant margin. That means trouble for the future of love and relationships," write some op-ed writer. And then the title of the article is "A Good Man is Getting Even Harder to Find." And people got mad at this. The tweet got ratioed. Probably one of the biggest was from Stephanie Ruhle, who's a MSNBC host. And she wrote, "Really, Gerard T. Baker? The growing number of well-educated women will lead the downfall of relationships? Maybe it will transform them for the better, create more equal partnerships, increase earning potential. Or maybe it'll empower women to have the financial freedom to dump losers." And what's funny to me about that is that her last sentence of her tweet is agreeing with his thesis, right? The whole premise of his theme and, you know, which, like I said, it reflected the social science. The whole theme of the social science is that women having higher socioeconomic status than men, combined with the norm of hypergamy, means that women dump losers, and there's a lot of losers out there. And then Avery James, who's a undergraduate and a Twitter friend of mine, he pointed out, he had a tweet where he said, "Same take, different online cohort mad," where he pointed out that whereas it was mostly women reacting with indignation of, you know, basically saying like, "Oh, men are upset that we're too educated and it hurts their egos, blah, blah, blah," to the Wall Street Journal one. A month ago, the New York Post had a very similar article as the Wall Street Journal one, but that time it was kind of the manosphere that was getting mad at it, because the New York Post headline was, "Broke men are hurting marriage prospects for American women." And then, of course, the reaction then was like, "Oh, so it's bad for women? What about for the men? They're the one who are broke," you know? Anyway, so it's just interesting how people react to this, you know, fairly robust social scientific phenomena.
Well, I have a reaction to this, right?
Yeah.
So there are two things that I wish we'd be better with in the social sciences, right? You know, get beyond demography and think more deeply about this, because, I mean, number one, what makes you marriageable, right? So to me, I'm just like, are you hot, right? Do you like to read? Do you like to discuss what you've read? Right? You don't need to have a college degree for all of that, right? Are you nice, right? Do you like to share the housework, right? Or even if you don't like it, you won't complain about it. Those are the things to me that make you marriageable. Do you have a job that you actually enjoy, right? And that, you know, whatever, you bring home an income, you don't need to have a college degree for that. Let me tell you something. I know plenty of men who have college degrees who are not hot, who do not read, who cannot have discussions, right? And have jobs that they hate. And then they come home and they take it out on their, you know, on their kids and their wife, right? And so I think we need, I think, an updated conversation about what marriageable or marriageability actually means for women in the United States. And if women in the United States are still stuck on this notion that, like, well, marriageable means that you need to have a college degree, right, then I think we need a revolution in thought.
Well, what the data shows is that the expressed preferences of American women is that marriageable means college degree and or good job.
Yep.
Yeah, and one of the things that's driving the shortage of marriageable men is that there's a fairly high rate of non-labor force participation for American men.
You know what, though? I admit I do not know a lot of this literature. I processed that last piece and I walked away with the impression that it was pretty flawed. Mm-hmm. And I see the Wall Street Journal piece talks about sex inequality in the sense that women are all gravitating towards the same set of men on dating sites, whereas men are like interested in a wider range of women. But like,
that's not true either, right? I mean, men, there's extreme inequality in the amount of messages that women receive on dating sites, and it's almost entirely a function of physical attractiveness.
You know, and it's also probably like there's two things going on. Are we talking about finding partners or are we talking about casual sexual encounters? Like, what does online dating apps tell us, right, when mm-hmm. people are looking for different things? So I'm not even convinced that that hypothesis is so well established, though I don't pretend to be an expert. And my sense when I read the comments is there's like two communities of women's views at work. There's a lot of men who are reading it approvingly and almost saying, please release us from this expectation that we earn more from women than women. They're like, please, we want this to be done. And then there are women who are angry that are saying, you are perpetuating this idea that men have to out-earn by like framing marriage as an economic transaction where the man is, you know, we are telling everybody that women want this. It's not so clearly established, and it's almost reinforcing the, you know, the belief that men have to over-earn. I feel like when I read those comments to the story on Twitter, I saw a bunch of people who were angry at each other, but both fundamentally wanting to get rid of the gender norm.
Well, what was funny is in the most recent reaction, a lot of it was framing it as if there's a norm of male hypogamy rather than a norm of female hypergamy, right? Like the reactions were very often of the sort of, well, maybe men shouldn't have such bruised egos about women out-earning them. Whereas my understanding looking at the data is that it's more an issue of women not wanting to marry losers, which I don't blame them, you know?
Yeah, but what is a loser, Gabriel? Right? What is a loser?
Well, in the synthetic husbands paper, it was basically a man without a college degree who earns under 25 grand a year. And there's a lot of those guys and they're all single. So if that's your taste, you know, maybe you can find a hot one.
Hey, if he's hot and he's going to be the next like drummer for like some huge band, I mean, who's the loser now, right?
Well, that's a big if.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just saying,
a lot of women have made bad mistakes by thinking
that. It's true. It's true.
Yeah. Well, maybe he'll get a record deal. Yeah.
I used to have a thing for drummers in my, you know, high school years. Yeah. But I mean, drummers aside, I mean, I actually think losers come in all shapes and sizes. And I think that we tend to, for whatever reason, say, well, you know, if you make, you know, like high six figures, right? And, you know, whatever, and you work yourself to death, then you're somehow a winner, even though you never get to spend any time with your wife.
In that synthetic husband's paper, marriageable wasn't high six figures. It was more high five figures.
Yeah, no, I'm obviously exaggerating to make a point, but I think that exaggeration is well placed because how many people would actually look at someone who was such a high earner and say, dude, that guy's a loser, right? And I'm just saying, like, you can be a loser, right, as a husband, while being a winner as an earner.
Eric, what's your take on the shortage of marriageable men and the reactions to it?
It's a very good question.
Why would you prefer to just not touch it with a 50-foot pole?
What's the publishing angle to this? I mean, I think this is a good question. I mean, it also is a good segue in some ways to the next topic that you wanted to talk about. My take on it would be that we have very constrained ways in which we are able to kind of perceive the success of our life course. And I think that, you know, I think Leslie's point about trying to expand that out in some way is pretty important.
You know, when I think of everything in terms of household finance, because that's what I do.
Oh, I thought you were going to say in terms of Canada, but.
No, well, there's also that. But For finance, you know, I think there are two logics. I see a lot of successful married college graduates adopting sort of a flexible strategy where they both, where as a group, they just try to maximize the overall well-being with whoever can assume the higher paying job or the more out of home role. And I think that's like a modern view, or maybe a view that is newer in terms of how we understand marriage. And it has yet to catch on. And I think a lot of this marriageable man hypothesis are people who are still trying to wrestle with that new mode of existing as a couple. And then you have a lot of, you know, a lot of critics. I think a lot of the critics that Gabriel had are people who are well acquainted with that new mode of marriage and don't understand that all of those men who are like, well, I can't be the breadwinner. How am I going to find myself a woman? They don't understand that, like, these people don't aren't getting it, right? Like, there's a new way that they're just not computing yet.
Well, so there is some evidence that there's cohort change as to the norm. There is some evidence that more recent cohorts are more egalitarian in their relationships. So there was a finding that this isn't directly about market labor force participation, but about household chores. But there was a finding that couples have less sex when men do traditionally feminine housework, mm-hmm. and have more sex when husbands do traditionally masculine housework. And this was seen as reflecting gender performance. And in fact, this was predicted by stuff like Weston Zimmerman. But that was based on 1990 survey data. And if we replicate that with more recent survey data, the effect goes away. So, you know, that's evidence that there was a certain amount of expectations of gender performance and, you know, breadwinner marriage and all that sort of stuff within older cohorts, but not so much with recent cohorts. Mm-hmm. And then likewise, to give fairness to the idea that there is not just a norm of female hypergamy, that is women marrying up, but also a norm of male hypogamy. There's some evidence that when men are in hypogamous marriages, they actually do less housework. Mm-hmm. Right? That is to say, when a man is out-earned, he'll actually do less housework than when he makes the same or more than his wife. And the logic there is that he feels emasculated by his lack of market income. And so he reasserts gender performance by eschewing housework, which is the opposite of what you'd expect in either an egalitarian or exchange framework, but does fit with a gender performance framework. But to the best of my recollection, those studies are all old. Yeah. And it may be that with more recent cohorts, you wouldn't see that kind of breadwinner gender performance.
I mean, I don't know if you've been in the paper source recently, but there's like an entire, like, you know, one of those coffee table books about the things that women find sexy. And apparently one of those things is, you know, when your man does the dishes. Now that's a traditionally female role. And actually, yeah, I mean, hey, if you bake me a cake, like, I mean, don't you remember that scene in Napoleon Dynamite? I mean, it was awesome for a reason. If a dude baked me a cake in high school that looked like that, I would go to prom with him.
Well, I mean, I saw some of those, Slate articles and whatever about chore play. But what was interesting about the chore play articles is a lot of them were really butch housework. It was like, you know, build a fire pit in the backyard, you know, or something like that. It wasn't do the dishes. It wasn't do the laundry. It was so that. Some of the aspects of that actually did fit with traditional gender performance.
But you know what? I'm wondering, like, so if we're talking about heterosexual couples here, like, do men not find a woman being able to, you know, like, make the fire in the fire pit sexy? I mean, isn't that sexy? I mean, come on.
My understanding of the literature is that women have stronger gendered expectations than men do. That, you know, like I keep saying, if you look at the survey data of what do women want out of male partners and what do men want out of female partners, women have expectations of hypergamy or at least parity, whereas men are somewhat indifferent. Like men, there's fairly few men who are like turned off by the idea of a successful woman.
Yeah, but what about displays of femininity or masculinity, right? I mean, so thinking about hyper or hypogamy in that specific sense, that's one thing. But thinking in terms of, oh, like, do you like totally conform to like gender roles? So, you know, like, do you not expect your husband to sing your child to sleep? Or are you turned off by your husband doing that? And what about your wife? Like, do you think it's cool that, you know, she can totally sling, you know, whatever. What do you call those things? A chainsaw. right? You know what I mean? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I would find that to be sexy, right? And I would feel sexy doing that myself, right? So
I feel like if we put him in a model, the R squared is going to be pretty low in terms of mate selection. All of those
chainsaw. It's like, yeah, we put in attractiveness, college education, earnings, chainsaw juggling, you know, chainsaw juggling dropped out.
Neri, I'm just saying.
It does seem like that this is a kind of topic where surveys are not necessarily the best research tool.
Yep.
You know, because they're so, it's just so complicated and so individualized and personal.
Right.
And that some of these things are also learned through the course of a relationship with a partner, that you don't know that you were into chainsaw slinging until you actually.
I also wonder, you know, I think back to the article that we reviewed the last time. And, you know, I wonder if a husband that is happy to watch the kids and, you know, is willing to be happy in a marriage where his wife is the breadwinner and all that, is not the behavior of somebody with a lot of human capital on their own and a lot of cultural capital on their own. It's like rich people behavior. And so even if you're cool with it, that's almost a way of signaling, you know, cultural capital or, you know, being urbane or whatever. And I feel like the variables are all so mixed up. I can't even get a sense of whether this marriageable man thing is even a thing. You know, I see where a lot of females are angry because they're like, listen, enough with this. Who earns more money? Like, can't we just talk about relationships where people cooperate towards joint ends and things like that?
Well, I mean, Joe, I think that's a great point. And I think that the whole marriageable man thesis is really just an explanation for why marriage rates are not as high as they once were, right? That is like one like hypothesis for that, right? One tiny bit of it. I think also it just might be a big part of it is that plenty of women out there and also plenty of men are like, you know what? I'm having a really good time just the way that I am, right? And it's going to take a lot for me to give up that autonomy that I enjoy, right? So I think that that is actually part of it. And I think, you know, we would rather say, or we would rather hold up this hypothesis that it's like, men, you gotta go to college than to think that like the norms in our society, right? Like dictating like, you know, the ways in which we're supposed to be paired off and you know, sort of the institutions that we're supposed to care about, like those are changing. And I think that that's what I think it is more than anything else.
There's also a mismatch. Like a lot of the comments seem like men who are sex seeking and wondering why partner seeking people don't find them attractive, but they're not acting as partner seekers. They're acting as sex seekers. And there's like almost two markets going on and people aren't realizing that what we think of as one market is two.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of sex seekers wondering why relationship seekers aren't behaving like them.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you ever want to get depressed, talk to one of your female friends about their experiences on dating apps and they'll have, you know, stories that'll make you realize that we all live in the shadow of original sin. So on this issue of like female preferences, right? So the synthetic husbands paper we discussed last week is based on census data. And so that can measure expressed preferences. But that's for partner formation. Mm-hmm. And then for like the initial stages, the best way to study it is probably, you know, online dating. And my favorite paper there's a lot of great papers on online dating, but probably my favorite is one by Elizabeth Brook, where her data, and with these, it's always important to look at which data set. And she used an ethnically particular, you know, dating website. So she's not saying it's J-Date, but it's J-Date.
It is.
Anyway, so that's my inference. She never let it in, right? J-Date right. Lawyers don't need to sue her. I'm guessing. Yeah. Anyway, so.
Like we all assume that, no?
Exactly. I thought so.
So, I mean, is that or farmers only? So I'm looking at the appendices of the PNAS, and she talks about, you know, basically who gets interested in whom. And she shows that for women with exactly a BA, there's not really a consistent pattern of whether they're more likely to swipe on men with a BA versus a high school degree. But if you look at women with more than college, there's a pretty pronounced pattern that they are much more likely to write to college-educated men than high school-educated men. Mm-hmm. Whereas that pattern does not exist for it exists for few. Basically, there's no pattern for even men. So basically, guys like me with a PhD, we're not terribly like, we don't really care whether women have a high school degree or a college degree. Whereas women with, say, a PhD or law degree or something like that are much more likely to contact a man who has a college degree.
You've been listening to The Annex, a sociology podcast. Special thank you to Eric Schwartz from Columbia University Press. We're on the web, sociocast.org/annex, on Twitter @SociAnnex, and on Facebook, The Annex Sociology Podcast. Our producer is Liseth Moreno, music by Lena Orsa. On behalf of Leslie Hinkson and Gabriel Rossman, I'm Joe Cohen. Thanks for listening.